Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm producer Caleb, and today we're doing a special episode on the show. It's been a while since we've done one of these. We have been so focused on the apologetic series and coming into our next series that we just haven't had a lot of guests on the show recently. But today we're coming right off of our anniversary specials, and we're starting in an in-between period. We're between series, we're between our apologetic series and what will be the Great Minds of the Christian Church series. And so we're going to have some guests on the show, and we're going to kick it off today. Dr. Keith, I want you to introduce the guest today and get us rolling.
Yeah, our guest today is Johan Hinderly. I first met Johan when I was hanging out with my friend Aaron in Minnesota. Aaron and I were working on a project called Wittenberg Institute at the time, and we went, Aaron took me up to the camp where Johan was the director, which is called Mount Carmel, and I had been told that Johan was this wonderful Norwegian pietist Lutheran. I don't know if that's true or not, Johan. You can correct me. But we get to the camp, introduced to Johan. We go over to Johan's house, and he starts pouring martinis. And I said to myself, this is an interesting pietist. The first point I meet him, he's pouring me a martini. I connected with Johan again today. We had lunch today, and I threw at him the idea, very short notice, of coming and doing a Thinking Fellows episode on sort of Christian camp ministry. And for our listeners who aren't aware of it, I kind of came into teaching, really, maybe, and doing theology by virtue of wanting to be a camp counselor and wanting to be a camp director. And for years, I attended Arrowhead Lutheran Camp up here in the San Bernardino Mountains, right outside of where we now own our cabin. By the time I was 15, I started working there. I was a lifeguard, I was a camp counselor, I was assistant program director, I was maintenance. I kind of did everything a young man could do at a camp. In a lot of ways, I talk about this a little bit in the book, Being Dad. I didn't have a dad growing up, and my first real sort of full-time dads were different directors and program directors that became part of my family as I worked at camp full-time from the time I was 18 on, taught me many things about being a man, especially. And I have a very special place in my heart for Christian camping ministry, and especially its history in Lutheranism. When I used to train my staff, I would use a book by David Burrow called How to Be a Great Camp Counselor. There's some really good parts to that book. There's some parts to it that the more mature self of me would say, that's a little different. But one of the stats I remember in there, and I would use with my counselors all the time, is that he said, and he wrote this book in the 90s, I think. And he said in there, 1992. He said in there that at the time when surveyed, when Christian adults were surveyed, 25% of them would say they first heard the gospel at a Christian camp. Mm-hmm. That when they were asked, when and where did you first hear the gospel? It would be at a Christian camp, usually by their camp counselor. Right. And I thought, man, what a wonderful opportunity for evangelism. And even really, to some degree, as the kids get older and they come to camp and as you have families come in, apologetics. When I took over as the director of Arrowhead Lutheran Camp when I was older, after I graduated from Concordia, I started a little apologetics institute there for teenagers. And it was an incredible thing. You'd see these kids that you knew when they were kids, you know, they came to be 16, 17, 18, wanted to work at the camp. And one of the things I'd say is, you want to work at the camp during the winter, we're going to have an apologetics academy, come on up, and I'll invite some guys that I know. Craig Parton came up, Dr. Rosenblatt came up at one point and did apologetics training for teenagers who were about to be camp counselors, because, you know, by the 90s, and I'm sure earlier than that, apologetic questions were rampant with older kids as you went through the Bible studies. And so I have a great place in my heart for that. You did it for 30 years. I mean, I did it for almost a decade, actually. But you did it for 30 years, and I thought, let's talk about it. How did this start? There's a great tradition of this in Lutheranism. Yeah. I mean, just a wonderful tradition of this in Lutheranism. Some of that's being lost now to some degree. I mean, Arrowhead Lutheran Camp is closed. Mount Cross up in Northern California, which was one of our other Lutheran camps, it has a hard time staying afloat. And there's just not as well attended as they once were and that type of thing. But what's the history here? You said you had this great idea of starting with Jesus and his disciples, so let's do it.
Well, you know, a camp is an experience that makes a person uncomfortable. You got to leave home. You got to go somewhere where leaps up some other kind of an environment, a bed, a tent, or something. And so when Jesus calls his disciples to follow him, he takes them out of their comfort zone. They become, in effect, displaced people. And it isn't an unreal category for thinking when you consider the fact that when Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden, they were displaced. They did not have a place any longer, and they were literally on the move. And all throughout the history of the Bible, you have these stories of people who are in some way or another wandering, and they find a small place of comfort and safety and peace in the presence of the Lord. And the outcome is there's a community. And that's one of the things that the camps created for these kids. They experience community in an environment where mom and dad were not running the show, right, where they didn't have an accountability to some system or setting that was predictable. And I think the other thing that happened was is they got a chance to come under the grace of God. I mean, there's all kinds of legalisms that permeate every environment. But when you throw kids by a lake or by a river or out in the woods or something like that, all of a sudden,
there's freedom.
Things percolate. Yeah. That previously were not even visible or accessible to your eye.
Right. Yeah, that was definitely true of me. I mean, I grew up raised by women. Yeah. I went to camp, and there was this weird freedom that I hadn't had. There's, you know, canoes and lakes and hikes and trees, right, and just getting dirty and not taking baths and, you know,
exactly,
the whole gambit of it. And a community. I was always shocked and amazed. Every year I'd go to camp, I was always shocked and amazed how close I could become to another boy in 5 days' time.
Right.
You know, where you felt like at the end of those 5 days, like you were losing a part of you when you said goodbye.
Exactly.
And that feeling, as I got older and started working with the kids, that existed, you know, even as a counselor to the kids. Yeah. You literally felt like you, many times, like you're saying goodbye to your own child.
Right.
I mean, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah, and the wonderful thing about it is that, you know, we in our home turf figure out all the ways to control accessibility to ourselves. So then when you're out in the woods somewhere and all of a sudden you have to give up those reins, then the Spirit working through the communion of saints that's there, the word that's proclaimed, all of a sudden you have a sense of, wow, I see myself differently. I mean, I see myself as God sees me in a way that I maybe could never have done, right, just staying at home. And
an amazing amount of declared forgiveness that goes on.
Well, that's the other thing. You know, you are thrown together with other kinds of kids who snore. Yeah. They fart. They do all kinds of other things. They burp. They have trouble with various kinds of kids. Wet beds in camp. Mm-hmm. They get diarrhea. They throw up. All kinds of things happen, and all of a sudden you got to cope with all these different kinds of problems that kids have that you don't have to deal with if it's just your mom and your sister and your dad back in the house. And how do you deal with these strange things that kids go through? And you know this as a camp director, when you deal with those problems and a child senses that he's not made to feel guilty, he's not ashamed, he's not anxious about himself, even though whatever it is that caused him his trouble may have surfaced a little bit, he's able to relax and he sees something about himself that he couldn't before. And that's one of the reasons why I think when you talk about the other side of this, the church, it cannot help but be the walls, the building, the institution. I mean, no matter how open you are as a kid, you always see it from the point of view of its regulatory.
We're going to church.
Yeah, and it's, there's always somebody there that's running things. But like you say, you get out in the woods, you get out by the lake, and the rules are set aside. And there may be some rules. We used to have two rules at Mount Carmel. One was courtesy. That came out of Romans 14 and 15, not to do something that would create offense. And I did that mostly because I didn't want to police people who had brought alcohol to camp, you know, and they'd say, oh, you can't drink here. You can't drink. I didn't want to go through that. Last thing I needed to be was a policeman. I wanted to help people get free, not to be more shackled. So but all we said was just courteous. Just don't drink at the beach where you may cause somebody else. And I never talked about alcohol. I used to use it. It was like music. Not everybody likes Bach or something. So some of you older people who brought your boom boxes along, you know, you got to tone them down a little bit. You can't play them too loudly. So
I think ideally that'd be the same thing for like living on a college campus for the first time, that there wouldn't be this long set of 30-page rules.
Yeah.
There'd be sort of this idea of be courteous.
Yeah, right.
You know? Play your music loud, but if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, your neighbor might need to get some rest because he's got an exam in the morning.
There you go. Right. And the other thing was safety, you know, just because the obvious concerns with people's well-being. But those two simple guidelines helped us all the way through our ministry. So we didn't have. I remember one thing that bugged me about some youth camps that would go to, and they'd read these lists of rules. The director would come out. And he'd read this list.
And that was his job.
It was.
Yeah. That was the one time you'd see the director all week was when he was giving you the law.
Exactly. And I learned something from a guy named Schmitz, who was a faculty member at Luther Seminary. He came out of Latvia after World War II. He actually escaped before the war was over. But he had a great help. He talked to me about authority. And he said the word authority comes from the Greek word augeo. And you grow in the presence of someone who has authority over you. And I think when a camp director conveyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, kids could grow into that. And I know that the counselors did. They gave grace to kids. I remember when I was a camp director, we sneaked out at one night and did all kinds of mayhem and sneaked back in. And the next day they were mad as anything. Who did this? Who said this? You got to tell. And all of my boys were just real quiet, standing behind me. You know, we just had all screwed up. I hadn't done anything too bad, but, you know, just doing something a little bit off the wall and something different that helped us all kind of relax and love each other in a different way.
It's funny. When I first came to Concordia, I didn't yet know Dr. Rosenblatt, but I showed up to my first semester. My first class was Doctrine 1, and I sit down in class, and up at the front of the class is now Dr. Steve Mueller, who just so happened to be my first camp counselor when I was 7 years old at Arrowhead Lutheran Camp. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's Bigfoot. That's my camp counselor, and now he's my professor, and he's doing the same thing.
Yeah.
He's teaching me the faith here in class, just like he was for I had him for 3 years as a counselor at camp. Just as he did at camp, and he's sharing the gospel with me in class just as he did at camp.
Right.
And there was an amazing kind of continuity there for me that I thought, there's a full circle to this. You know, the university is certainly not the camp. The camp is not the university. But when they're both focused on the freedom and the gospel that we have in the Lord Jesus Christ, there's an amazing sort of continuity that can come out of that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And that's one of the reasons that I believe camps, when they move away from that premise, whatever other agenda they create, there's no life.
Right.
You have rhetoric, but you don't have the living Christ.
Right.
You know, Christ comes through the proclamation of the word and through the experience of forgiveness and sharing the faith. And that's when that's not there, then it's just a lake and not that comfortable.
That's right. It's YMCA.
Yeah.
Or worse.
And then the outcome is, well, I'm better off going to soccer camp or volleyball camp.
And you probably should, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Right.
So we don't have illusions about this being Christianity. In the early years of the ELC and ALC and some of these other churches, the camps were developed by churches. They wanted their kids to have this renewal. They knew that the renewal had to come when mom and dad were not in control. And so they set them up and they bought land or rented land or something. And that's why a lot of these camps have real prime real estate, because they were bought by Christians who wanted an environment where their kids could experience some of this renewal.
Right.
And then they'd go there, and it wasn't, like I say, it was tents. They didn't have very nice cabins. They didn't have directors in those days. They just had people coming in and volunteering
for a week. Yeah.
But the whole idea was to build community.
Right.
And I'm sure this is a reason why so many people became Christians from that, because the experience of Christian community that was authentic happened in environments where these people knew there were no strings attached. There was nothing around them that was sort of enforcing this. It was just they were in an environment for 5 days or whatever it was, and they had to collaborate, they had to listen, they had to share, in order sometimes to survive, but certainly to at least make the most of the moment.
Yeah, I'm probably overplaying my hand a little bit here, but I'm the guy who, when you sort of get the classical descriptions of heaven, I kind of cringe. You know, I sort of get these ideas of, all of us standing in nice, perfect lines and wearing choir robes and singing day and night, you know, Bach hymns and whatnot. Yeah. It's not that I don't like Bach, don't get me wrong, but I think of that and I'm like, oh my gosh, really? But
this gets to a fact of life that you may want to know about. You know, Ole was dying.
Oh, yes.
And it was just right near death. And Lena, who probably could someday be in charge of the heavenly order of people, was working downstairs, and Ole was just on his last breath. And all of a sudden, the fragrance of homemade lefse came upstairs. He was just enjoying all his childhood. Memories are coming back, and this wonderful, wonderful aroma. She had been rolling it out from the, mashed the potatoes, and there was butter on it, and then he could smell that she was even putting brown sugar.
Oh, I'm getting
and
hungry.
All of that was just coming upstairs. And so Ole crawled out of bed, and he pulled himself down those stairs without causing any more pain to his body that was already there. And he got up right next to the table, and he reached up, and he was hoping to get himself a little piece of lefse. And all of a sudden, Lena came over and slapped his hand. No, she said, those are for your funeral. So she'd be one of those ladies
she
in charge
would.
Of that heavenly
she
order
would.
You were just describing.
But I think of, you brought up the idea of camp and community, and I love it, really, because when you're a kid and you go to Christian camp, right, there was 2 points on the days which you knew were going to be sort of plugged in, where somebody was expressly going to try to give you the word. It was going to be the Bible study after dinner, usually, and the campfire, which signified the end of the day. The rest of your day was spent in community. And as I've grown and I've sort of understood our doctrine of vocation better, it's sort of amazing. Because when I teach on good works, I'll often say, if you want to understand Ephesians 2:10, it's basically wake up, get out of bed, go pour yourself a cup of coffee. And if you're married, pour one for your wife, give her a kiss on the cheek and say good morning as you hand her the cup of coffee, right? That's sort of your good works. You're just walking in the steps of your day-to-day routine in your community, which for most of us is our family. When you're at camp, you wake up, right? You head down to breakfast. You have breakfast. You, with your little community, you go to archery. Then you, with your little community, you go to snack time. Then you go, you know, from here to there. And it's never, for me as a child, it was never more sort of, my life in a Christian community was never as simple and or as understandable as those sort of days going from archery to arts and crafts to lunch to eventually Bible study and then eventually campfire at camp. And whereas the idea of heaven being singing in a heavenly choir makes me cringe, the idea of going to campfire every night never made me cringe.
Yeah.
You know, and I was doing that in my community, and I was definitely, it can be good or bad, right? There's some really wacky things sometimes that happen at camps that I'd say theologically is, but there's a lot of gospel.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of first order, straight proclamation, forgiveness of sins that comes across when it's done well. And I think of, if I sort of picture living in a community of other Christians like that for the rest of my life, I can think, okay, yeah, I have a picture of that from my childhood that's, I'm sure, not the same picture, but it makes it understandable to me and seemingly enjoyable to me too.
One of the other elements about that camping experience was that kids needed to do some form of work. There were chores to be done.
Absolutely.
And the chores were an important part of the success of the week.
Sure.
In order to, you know, clean up the dishes or clean up
sure.
latrines or whatever it was. And they recognized that we're in this together.
Right.
We're only here for a week, but we're in it together. So in
right.
some ways, I think camps do provide a little foretaste of the kingdom, because we recognize this is a moment in time. It's eternity. We're receiving this space of grace, and we have a chance to really bless one another in a lot of different ways. One little thing that happened at a camp, this is not an Ole and Lena story, but it could be if I just called him that. But this was
I told Johan he had to tell some Ole and Lena jokes if he came on.
This is one of those situations where they were doing a musical presentation. And one of the girls, Debbie, was singing, and she was a little ticked off because she had a great voice. And her role in this little musical piece wasn't nearly as significant as she believed was warranted for her talent. And there was another guy who was in the same thing named Rolf. And Rolf came over to her and he said, Debbie, get over it. You're not singing for yourself. You're singing to the glory of God. You know, and she went, okay, you're right.
Yeah.
You know, but that was such a tremendous word for her to hear from her friend about, and she knew it was true.
Absolutely.
And that's the kind of thing that, you know, how many, you know, that would have been thousands and thousands of dollars of counseling to help Debbie out of herself. And
that's right.
In one short message, she got free.
It's like that. I forgot the name of that old comedian. It's like that skit where Lady comes in to see a psychiatrist and he's like a psychiatrist and she tells him all the problems and he just looks at her and goes, stop it. She goes another 5 minutes of problems. He's like, okay, stop it. Why would you want to live like that? You're afraid to get out of the house. That was hilarious. All right. So we're going to take a quick break for our promo. And when I get back, I want to talk about sort of, you can tell us a little bit about Mount Carmel, Holden Village, and your sort of specific experience. I love the idea of camps came out of the congregation. My experience at Arrowhead Lutheran Camp was just like that. It was Pastor Luther Schwarzkopf, who was a pastor in San Bernardino, right off of Waterman Canyon Road, who first said, you know, I need to get some of these kids up to the mountain. He went up to the mountain. They first leased it. Over time, they bought the 45 acres or something like that, right in the middle of Crest Park, only, you know, I think a mile from Lake Arrowhead. And it developed over time. Volunteers all at first, and you can tell that by the way the buildings are built always, that it was volunteers. You know, you can kind of see the evolution of a camp. Like, that was obviously built by a volunteer. Oh, they brought a contractor in for this one. Yeah. So anyway, we'll talk a little bit specifically about your experience when you get back.
Great. Thanks.
Welcome to our break. Today we're going to talk about a book. We're going to talk about Dr. Keith's book. This episode's coming fresh off of or during the Giving Kids Grace conference that Dr. Keith will be speaking at. So yes, there's a time flux here. We're recording before that conference happens. But Dr. Keith, you think you can tie your book into the arch of what this episode is all about. So I'm going to let you give that a shot.
I'm kind of amazing that way, Caleb. I can do it this way. So, Being Dad, Father is a Picture of God's Grace. This book I wrote last year came out. It's doing pretty well, actually, for us. It's at 1517. It's our number one seller. And I'm thankful to all the people who have read it and support it, have brought me out to talk about it. And I think it's kind of a natural one to do here because I talk in there about not only some of the things that many of the things I got from Dr. Rosenblatt on being a dad and other people like Jim Nestigan, but I talk in there about you, Caleb, and your brother Joshua and your sister Autumn and your mom. And that all started when I first became a husband. I met your mom actually at Arrowhead Lutheran Camp. She came out to work. I was one of the program directors who hired her to come out to work. And I,
sounds like an inappropriate relationship.
Committed what would be some sort of, you know, policy break. For now, and dated her, and got engaged at the end of the summer, and the rest is history. But the idea in Being Dad is that Johan and I were just sort of talking about heaven, and he told a great Ole and Lena joke, and I said that, you know, my time at camp sort of served as this way for me to understand, like, what the community of faith and glory might be one day. Not a perfect example, but I think certainly not an imperfect one either, maybe an analogy. And one of the arguments that I make in Being Dad is that fathers serve that same role in the lives of their kids, right? They're what's called an analogia entis, or analogy of being to God the Father. And they're not perfect examples of God the Father, yet they're not, a good dad is not a completely imperfect example or analogy either, but he is that sort of foggy picture of what a good, loving, gracious father is in our Heavenly Father. And it's not a how-to book. I don't give you a bunch of sort of, you do this, this, and this, you'll have perfect kids. It's more about you.
Although I am perfect.
Yeah, right. It's more about you as a dad and the sort of the wonderful vocation that you've been called into, and how that plays out in the everyday lives of your kids. So you can check out Being Dad, Father as a Picture of God's Grace if you go to shop1517legacy.com.
Shop.1517legacy.com. You do it every time, but it's okay. It's in the show notes, people, so if you go check out our website, thinkingfellows.com.
Amazon.
Yeah, free if you live in Southern California, Being Dad is got it has free one-day shipping on Amazon Prime, so that's pretty cool.
And 5-star review.
Ooh. Yeah, it's got a lot of reviews.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
All right. See, told you I could tie it in.
All right, good job. All right, check it out. All right, you want to go back to what we're doing here?
Yeah, so Johan, you told us, you know, a little bit about the history of how, at least within some of the Lutheran churches, these ideas of Lutheran camp started. If you have more to say on that, it's great. Otherwise, maybe just tell us about what your work was
sure.
and your family history.
Glad to.
Your family history in Lutheran camping is kind of amazing.
Well, that's true. My dad started Holden Village, and basically, like Rod was mentioned a few minutes ago, Holden was originally a mining town that was for sale. They advertised it at least that way for several years, and a fellow from Lutheran Bible Institute in Seattle sent them letters and said, why don't you give it to LBI? And Rod had...
Which is Lutheran Bible Institute.
Lutheran Bible Institute, yeah. Yep. And Rod had a friend named Randy Stein who was involved in that. And so in any case, the whole dimension here was eventually this company called the Howe Sound Mining Company was willing to give it to Lutheran Bible Institute, and then Lutheran Bible Institute said, we can't handle this, so they shared it with the Missouri Synod, the LCA, and the ALC at the time. So three Lutheran churches plus LBI shared in the development of it, and they hired one person who was there a year before my dad, but he didn't continue, and then my dad took it over and ran it for 14 years.
Wow.
And during that time, one of the key things they created was a volunteer understanding of their life together. Everybody there was unpaid. People came from all over to work and to give and to share. And the only discipline they had, this was kind of their only rule, was every night at 8 o'clock, they wanted the whole community to gather around the Word, and that was the evening Vespers. It was lasted about half hour or so. But that became the basis of how that community found its identity. And there were obviously other things during the day with sharing, singing, announcements, other silliness that helped elevate that meaning. But it was truly a unique community of people. And one of the strengths of Holden Village always was that you couldn't just walk in. Well, you could, I suppose, if you hiked through the mountains, but very few people did that. You had to leave your car in a parking lot at one end of Lake Chelan, and you got on a boat, and that took you up this lake about 30 or so miles. And then there was a bus that came down from Holden that picked you up and that took you up these switchbacks about 11 miles into Holden Village. And so there was a certain feeling of really being out there and alone, and in that sense of the word that we talked about earlier, displaced. You were somewhat vulnerable, and there were a community of people around you whom you didn't know, and this community was shaped again by the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it became constantly that the word was always lifted up and helping people to see themselves through the proclamation of the gospel in Jesus. And over the years that my dad was in charge, there were always people that wanted to turn it into kind of a cult. And he always said, you know, there's all kinds of things already here that work in that favor. We have to keep it clear that this is a place shaped by the very same thing that shapes the local church, the preaching of Christ.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and that was his emphasis for years, and people got involved in various kinds of teaching and other kinds of experiences. Hiking was important, athletics of some degree, playing volleyball and various swimming experiences in the river.
I first heard of Holden Village from Jeff Mallinson, who's a colleague at Concordia, who at the time was the academic dean at Trinity Lutheran College in Everett, Washington. And I would say to anybody that knows Dr. Mallinson, if you ever want a very entertaining night, get a couple of drinks in him and ask him to tell you the story about the time he had to make it back from Holden Village to an emergency board meeting at Trinity Lutheran College. Yeah. And if you want to sort of have a mental picture of the distance. I've never been to Holden Village, but from Jeff's telling of the story, the access issues become really clear.
Right.
You know, as he has to get to this meeting, and at one point he's looking at hiring a helicopter.
Yeah.
You know, because he just can't, between the boat and the bus and the car, and he just can't figure out how to get back. And that vulnerability, but he speaks, I mean, just very highly of it too.
And some of that, the difficulty eventually became one where the environment began to trump the message.
Right.
And so instead of having...
Which you have to be careful of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's a temptation. You know, this is one of the things about camping. When there are movements, and movements of the Spirit and movements of the Word, the life of God is constantly at work in the midst of it. When they get institutionalized and somewhat defensible in some sort of system, then it loses its moment of freedom under Christ.
Yeah, I sometimes have said that theology in the mountains is wonderful, but the theology can never be about the mountain.
Right.
And once the theology becomes about the mountain or the mountaintop experience or whatever, you're really losing sight of the reason why it's valuable.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I know it. You know, that was what you mentioned heaven a little bit earlier, and I was thinking about a story I did know about Ole and Lena, and this is a little bit about a theological confusion with Ole. He and Lena both died. And they both ended up going to heaven at the same time. And while they were there, they were basically given an example of the very thing you were describing, all these elegant places. This is their mansion they're going to live in. And here was this beautiful vista. Sounds a little bit like California, I suppose, that they were going to be enjoying. And then there was this spread of food that was better than any smorgasbord that Ole had ever seen. And the Ole turned to their guide and he said, is this available? Yeah, the guide says, yeah, it's here all day long, 24 hours a day. You can eat as much as you want, and it never affects you at all. And he turned to Lena, and he was just furious. He said, Lena, you and your stinking diets. If it hadn't been for you, we could have been here 10 years ago. That was great. So, well, I was looking at someone to blame, you know.
I love it.
But that's one of the great things about the value of camping and the value of those experiences is that we get in environments where you actually lose some of the patterns of thinking that once shaped you too. Because the people around whom you happen to be living no longer are carrying the same sorts of agendas. You're all involved in similar kinds of activities, and there's a freedom and a relaxedness in there. I remember one time when I was with my kids, a little bit about being dad, and I lost my temper. And I sent them to their room, and I went back to the room, and I realized I was wrong. And I went in there, and the kids were in bunk beds, and this is kind of how they were set up in this little dorm at the camp. And I said to the boys, I said, I'm sorry, I was wrong, can you forgive me? And my youngest boy was on the bottom bunk, and he was kind of chuckling, kind of glad that dad had finally got it, you know. But the middle son, who was on the upper bunk, he was feeling sorry for me. I think he felt like, is there anything I can do to say something that'll help make dad feel a little better with his disappointment in himself? And so he said, Dad, that's okay that you lost your temper and got angry with us. You're our dad, and you're supposed to disappoint us.
Thanks for helping.
I know, exactly. So, you know, some of those environments where you're in camp and that those things happen, and you get really absolved by your kids in a sort of a back doorway.
That's
but
great.
That took place a lot at Mount Carmel, where my wife and I were in charge for many years. As I mentioned earlier, we didn't want to be policemen and women, and we wanted people to have freedom. So we just set it right from the beginning that there were only two rules. One was courtesy, the other was safety. And everything else we knew was shaped by the preaching of Christ. And we were aware, however, this is one thing that hit me pretty solidly. We had some people who came there as preachers, and they were moralists. And they were just awful. I mean, unfortunately, they were elegant. They had flamboyant language, beautiful stuff, but they were just terrible. And I remember after 1 week, I told our staff we did not hear the gospel this week, and they were very upset with me because the guy had ingratiated himself with so many of the staff. They thought that there was something wrong with me. But you could actually tell in the spirit of the place, because of his preaching, there was a nitpicking, there was negativity. And some of our other staff recognized this, that when Christ wasn't proclaimed, our behavior with one another was influenced by it. So that was a very profound thing for me, that you can't pretend that this happens just because we're all nice Lutheran folks in a beautiful outdoor setting.
Right.
Without Christ being preached and him lifted up, you don't gain the blessing.
Right. And now at Mount Carmel, one of the things that I didn't have a lot of experience with it, but you guys were kind of known for the family camps.
Yes, we were.
And Aaron introduced me to, you had some, I'm going to go to the audio that I love here, to you guys would actually bring like world-class speakers out to talk with these families during the day. And I thought, Holy cow, when could you as a family ever, you know, find a time to spend a week in this wonderful setting? It was a beautiful camp on a lake and just gorgeous setting.
That's right.
And not only do you get the setting, you get the camp experience, you get the activities, you get the counselors and, you know, all the fun at meals and the campfires and whatever. Right. But on top of that, you hear like world-class theologians come and talk to you about things like predestination and just heavy hitting topics. And I'm talking people like Gerhard Verdi, Steve Paulson, one probably lesser known that Aaron and I were talking about at lunch today that I love, Herb Lottings.
Yeah. Paul Zoll.
Paul Zoll.
Yeah, he was there a couple times.
And Jeff Mallinson.
Jeff, yeah, there we are. Another one we just heard mentioned earlier.
I mean, just incredible.
Yeah.
And
you know what was great about it? We had a guy from Princeton Theological Seminary come out who was a very difficult person. His name was Diogenes Allen. And he came out there, and he got so involved. He was so accessible. Here he was, a very sophisticated professor who had all kinds of literary abilities. But he was down to earth, and he said, "I'll come once." He came 7 times.
Oh my goodness! And, you know, I bet he did.
You know, it was for him,
right? I bet he did.
He loved what it did for his soul.
Yeah,
because, you know, he was in an erudite kind of an environment out there, in Princeton, where he had to sort of maintain a certain image. He didn't need to maintain it. I remember we were singing YMCA, you know, one time at a talent show, and here was Dick Allen go YMCA,
I just said last week or the week before, I was in North Dakota doing a bunch of speaking events on the Being Dad book.
Yeah.
And the first night, so I'm in North Dakota, it's 20 below zero.
Yeah.
The first full night I'm there, I get driven out, you know, 40 miles outside of Jamestown, which is where we were sort of centered, out to this camp. I don't even remember the name of it. And there's the pastor had brought in 70 men because it was a men's retreat, and I was sort of the keynote speaker for the men's retreat. And these are North Dakota farmers.
Yeah,
I mean, for the most part. And you bring out some California boy to talk to him about masculinity. It was kind of hilarious, to be honest with you. They later took me ice fishing. But you can see some of that reluctance, you know, right off the bat that first night. We're stepping here to some California kid about to talk to us about masculinity. But by the end of the night, the idea that these men, even just for 24 hours, got to spend that time excluded from their daily lives or sort of removed from their daily lives in the company, the community, you know, or as Luther put it, the mutual conversation and consolation of the brethren. You know, discussing ideas about being a dad, being a man, and then just having fun together, making jokes, you know, eating meals, praying. Yeah. It's remarkable. It reminded me again, you know, just even within a 24-hour period, when I went out to North Dakota, didn't even know I was going out to a camp, to be honest with you. It was just, I don't know, I can't really say enough about it. And I also can't really say enough about, at least in the LCMS, how, you know, it's sort of on the decline for us. I don't know. I would guess it's the same.
Yeah. Well, those camps that depend upon children are obviously suffering because there's lots of other things children can do.
Sure.
And the other side of it is there are fewer of them around.
Right.
So we don't have as many kids. And so camps are struggling a little bit to reinvent themselves. But the bottom line for me still is, if the camp doesn't understand its calling and the leader for his or her calling to shape the community under the word of Christ, the preaching of Christ, they can't be sustained. There isn't enough energy to sustain something which doesn't have a life of its own. And that life comes, of course, from the word outside breaking into us.
I totally agree. Totally agree. Well, do you have anything else to say as we wrap up? Tell us about Mount Carmel, maybe a little. I was only there for a couple of days, but I love Mount Carmel.
Yeah, well, Mount Carmel was a camp that also was a part of the LBI tradition in Minnesota, and it was set up as a teaching place, and it had a little bit of its own problems with Pietism. They had lots of rules.
I think camps are prone to that.
They tend to build it in as a way to defend something or protect themselves, and I kept thinking, what do we got to lose?
You know? I think even the LCMS camps are definitely prone to that, too.
Yeah. One guy came up to me. It was a hot day, and he came up. He said, would it be okay, Pastor? I think he called me Pastor, even though I didn't ever like to go by that. If we could go swimming today? And it was one of these hot, sultry days in Minnesota. The humidity was just awful. And I looked at him. I said, why? He says, well, our rules are that you're not supposed to swim on the first day we arrive. Some I don't know where that came from. I looked at him. I said, it would be a sin against the Holy Spirit for you not to go swimming today.
That's great. So
that was part of the humor of it all. We had saunas there, and one of my friends stoked up the sauna real hot one time, and it burned down. And he was just a kid.
For those of you who aren't Norwegian, that's a sauna.
Yeah. And it was on fire. We went down to put it out, and he says, I was always expecting you to just jump on me. And at the end of it, I said, well, we've lost our sauna now. We got to go celebrate our defeats. Let's go up and have some ice cream.
That's funny.
You know, the Lord prepares a table before us in the presence of our enemies.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could do things that celebrated life in environments like that where
right.
you had a little bit of freedom for that kind of experience. And you weren't manipulated by, I mean, there wasn't anybody saying, can't do that, shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
So gave a lot of joy to it.
And, well, there's no wonder why you were a great camp director. I mean, to hear somebody talk about the experience as centered on the gospel and centered in freedom
absolutely.
Is truly unique and truly wonderful. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, my privilege. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, it's been great.
Great.
Enjoyed
Thank
it.
You.
All right, we'll catch you next time.